Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamson and Dan, read the paper. It's once again Sunday, and it's October 28th.
Yeah, sounds right.
We're on the verge. We're on the cusp of Halloween.
Right.
Halloween is coming. But we've already told all our best Halloween stories, probably.
Well, we'll see.
There will be none of that. But I thought it was worth revisiting what the show is, in case people don't understand. All right? So weekly we do this podcast loosely based on old-time radio shows, where there would be couples that actually sat there in their Fifth Avenue apartment and read the newspaper on a daily basis.
Well, certainly Sundays. I mean, did they do it every day?
Yeah, they had Pagin and Ed Fitzgerald had a daily show.
Well, the key word is loosely. Okay.
And there was Dorothy Kilgallen
and her husband
Dick, Dorothy and Dick, etc.
Right.
So the idea is we don't literally read the articles, but we do just, you know, kind of summarize.
We read the articles, but we don't read them out loud.
No, we're not here to read them to the audience. No.
We're giving you our acute, sharp take on the situation.
Of articles that appeal to us,
randomly. And events generally, movies, plays, and the like, right?
Yeah, not so much politics, never politics.
Never politics.
Because there are enough people commenting on that already.
I would say more than enough.
Yes. But just whatever interesting things catch our
eye. And we're available.
And, yeah, go ahead.
No, you are the expert. I know we're available on Spotify now.
Yes, you can listen to us on Spotify.
And YouTube.
You can conjure us up on YouTube
or
through the usual channels, iTunes, etc.
Right.
Just search for Tamson and
Dan. That require no conjuring. No conjuring involved in those.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. So there you have it. And, you know, today we're going to start with, you know, sometimes we throw out things we've been up to, and last night I was dragged to First Man.
Dragged to First Man. I took you to a first-run movie. Not only did I take you to a first-run movie, but we sat in, what was that? What's that?
IMAX.
IMAX, which cost extra. We were in the IMAX theater. I don't think I've seen a movie in an IMAX theater before. I know you have.
But we have to get you out more.
Exactly. There's no question about it. And as far as I can tell, IMAX is just a movie theater with a bigger screen and perhaps some superior sound, which is all to the good. And First Man seems to be the right candidate for that kind of thing, because after all, it's about going to the moon, right?
Right.
And we know we have all those great special effects, which were quite excellent.
And quite special.
Yes, there's no question about it. First Man being the story of Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon, as portrayed by Ryan Gosling. His wife is portrayed by Claire Foy of The Crown, and it's directed by Damien Chazelle, famous for La La Land. And what was that movie about the...
Whiplash.
Whiplash, there you go. Who's a favorite director of ours and is from Princeton. And I had high hopes. I saw some great reviews. And I was a little disappointed.
I was underwhelmed.
Yes.
But I wasn't surprised to be underwhelmed, because the box office has not been spectacular.
Right. There's a divergence between some of the critical reaction, Rotten Tomatoes, let's say, and the popular reaction, which is usually a tip-off that something's a little bit awry.
Right.
And something was awry. Because there's a lot of great things about it. It certainly tells you in great detail, maybe even too great detail, but a lot of verisimilitude with respect to the development of the space program that led to landing on the moon. And certainly the story of Neil Armstrong, who deserves a biop, there's no question about it. And what the accomplishment's a great accomplishment. You can understand why one would want to chronicle it in great detail, which they do. The problem is, there are several problems, I guess several drawbacks. One is Gosling is very convincing as Neil Armstrong, and they don't seem to miss a beat on his portrayal. But he's not interesting in terms of watching for 2 hours because he's sort of shut down a little bit. That's part of his story.
Right.
He's repressed.
Yes.
So to hang
around. So there's nothing to see.
You would never, no one in real life would have spent 2 hours with Neil Armstrong voluntarily, unless, of course, you were strapped next to him in a space capsule,
right.
In which case you had no choice. I mean,
there are several scenes where somebody is trying to, like his wife or one of his best friends is trying to engage in mm-hmm. conversation with him. And they just can't get him to talk.
You can't do it.
So you're watching a guy not talk.
Exactly. Watching not talk. And it's like pulling teeth. He doesn't so much... look, he's a very admirable guy, but he doesn't so much spearhead the U.S. space program as survive it. It's harrowing. I mean, it's being stuck in one of those Disney rides like Space Mountain for 2 hours every 20 minutes. You're experiencing going up in this vibrating tin can. And it does certainly brings home the fortitude, the courage of these astronauts and the cost in lives. And the whole thing was kind of a crazy program.
That is true. And the early space capsule close up as portrayed in this movie really did look like a tin can.
Yeah, right. So you take away from it. But on the other hand, there's a little bit of the experience of you're just watching like the best social studies film strip you've ever seen. I mean, it's a little bit like that.
Well, it was interesting. It goes back and forth between the great scenery, you know, the shots of the rocket ships, the shots of the Earth, the moon, etc., and the almost like home movies of what's happening between him and his family and his friends and his coworkers. And it, you know, there's this, you know, constant back and forth between those two different worlds.
But there are attempts to even add some ballast to the movie by connected with the issue of was the space program worth the money and the political climate at the time. And they seem to answer that, yes, it was clearly worth it because whatever. Well, that's a very superficial analysis. They could have just taken that out of the movie. They didn't really, I don't know if that's an important question. Maybe it is, but they certainly didn't give an answer to it except to say we got there. But, you know, at the end of the day, the way you describe the Tamsin is almost more evocative and makes it seem like a more interesting movie than it ends up being because it doesn't quite mesh.
Well, clearly the makers are very engaged with that verisimilitude.
Right.
I mean, it seems they do incredible recreations.
Right.
And it just seems like they must get it. It just seems,
at the end of the day,
you're not engaged. You're not drawn in. You're not at all committed to the characters.
They've made a very small movie about a very big subject.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an odd thing to say. Again, we're Damien Chazelle fans, and it's not like we hated the movie. I thought it was worth seeing, but I can understand why
it's
not
being met with acclaim. I did look at my watch more than is advisable.
It's a lovely watch, though. It's certainly worth it. In any event, so we give you that note of caution on First Man. We expected more.
I mean, we did pay extra.
That's for the IMAX.
So I was expecting extra.
Well, it's about time I experienced IMAX. I'm not a young man anymore. So in any event, we're not ignoring Halloween completely. We're going to talk about Candy for a few minutes.
Well, all the big newspapers had articles about Candy.
It is.
Like a lot of articles about Candy.
You know what it is? The Times finally figured out that people give away candy on Halloween, and they're going crazy, as did the Journal.
And the Journal, I guess, had some article you mentioned to me about how what a big seller candy corn is.
Who knew?
Who knew? You know,
it is.
I think you seem to like candy corn. I don't quite get it.
I have what's called Philistine tastes. But you had much more interesting article in the Times about candy. We don't have to dwell on candy corn. We have sophisticated candy.
The New York Times Magazine section has at least a half dozen articles about candy. Okay.
And let me say, that's no exaggeration. It is a half a dozen.
Yeah, it's a
candy
theme is for their whole magazine section. And one will be interesting to our listeners in Colombia.
Yes, we do have listeners in Colombia.
We
We're not making that up.
We do have listeners in Colombia, more than just our children, I might add.
Yeah.
And which actually is a photo essay on a famous Colombian candy factory, Colombina, mm-hmm. in La Paya, mm-hmm. Colombia. I looked it up. It's about 6 hours drive from Bogota.
Mm-hmm.
In case you want to go there.
Yeah. All right. Keep it in mind next
okay.
trip.
Okay. Right. But, you know, it's always great to see factories in action, especially something as colorful as a candy factory. But the article I enjoyed the most was about licorice by Mark Benelli. And it's called Salty Tooth. And it's about Finnish licorice. Okay. And the kind of Finnish licorice that is called salmiakki. And it is salty licorice. All right. And licorice in general, not my favorite. Okay. I never got Twizzlers. Mm-hmm. That whole thing.
But the good news, it turns out it's not licorice.
It turns out that Twizzlers have no licorice in
exactly.
them. Okay, so that's not it. So what's the deal about licorice? And in this article, he says it's best described by Jerry Garcia in trying to describe the people who listen to the Grateful Dead. He says, our audience is like people who like licorice. Not everybody likes licorice, but the people who like licorice really like licorice.
Okay.
So it turns out there's this thing called salty licorice. And it turns out that group of people who like that are almost entirely in Northern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Including Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Finland, the Netherlands, and Northern Germany. Okay. And you may say to yourself, well, I like sea salt chocolate chip cookies. How bad can salty licorice be?
And the answer is bad.
Bad. It is not, the salt used in this candy is not sea salt or even table salt, but ammonium chloride, okay? Which really has an extraordinary taste. I think the author describes it as pungent, saltier than salt, in a way that really brought some heat, okay? The licorice also has an aggressive presence. May sound like a good thing, a potential balance to that ammonium chloride forward flavor, but it actually only seemed to intensify the curdled chemical aftertaste. Some combination of Diet Cola, fennel toothpaste, and MSG that multiple sips of water wouldn't flush.
Oh, God. But his point is that people love it, right?
The people who love it, love it. And not everyone does. He describes a conversation with a lover of a salmiakki who says he has two kids. One loves it. One can't stand it. Okay. But what's interesting about it is that Finland is like the fifth biggest, how would you describe it?
Consumer.
Candy per capita candy consumers in
right.
the world.
Candy,
number
not
five,
just licorice, just candy
not
in
just
general.
Licorice, number five.
And
okay?
That corresponds
there are
with,
others.
Right.
There are other yeah. salty licorice countries, Sweden, Netherlands, and right. Norway also are in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Also, it's worth noting that this is not considered a kid thing. This is not a niche product directed at children. In fact, some of the salty licorice candy actually has labels that say not for children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, but here's the interesting thing. Not only is Finland in the top five of candy consumers, they just scored the number one spot for world happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is, a survey done or an analysis done by the United Nations
right.
related group. Some of the other salty licorice countries are also
right.
at the top of list.
As we discussed it, there seems to be, on the surface at least, a serious correlation between the top consuming candy countries and the happiest countries. And we might also note that the U.S. is out of the top 10 on both lists.
Right.
As a matter of fact, this is as low as number 18 with respect to happiness.
With happiness. Well, I'm not surprised we're not happy, but I would have thought we eat
candy.
A lot of candy.
But now we've discovered the direct relationship between candy and happiness, and that's where we're lagging. That's the problem with the country. If only people ate more candy, and in particular more licorice, we'd be all set.
And so, you know, I mean, it's basically interesting that candy is so, you know, tied up with ideas of nostalgia and childhood, mm-hmm. and that you continue to take those things with you. And he does, in fact, towards the end of the article, say, what if, in fact, let me dial it back just a second. The worst licorice he tasted.
Yeah.
And he never comes around, you know.
Yeah.
He's never convinced. And he does some real taste testing with real experts. He really is not persuaded, but he does say the worst licorice he tasted turned out to be shaped like a red heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that is recommended to him by the producer, who said he should give it to his wife. He said, she will be happy with you for 6 weeks after she eats that.
Well, that's a whole different subject.
Okay.
But yeah.
but anyway, so that turns out to be horrible. What if, in fact, it merely represents a national tendency towards masochism?
Some understandable but
aberrant quality born of endless winter nights that wound up manifesting itself in a fanatical love of saunas and Turkish peppers.
Yeah, see, I don't believe any of that. Look, I'm going back to the correlation between the happiness on the one hand and the candy on the other, which goes beyond licorice, and there might be something to it. Who knows?
And there was also, actually, there was also a thing on the TV about a Swedish company called Lakrids, who is marketing a very high-end salty licorice all over the world, including Chelsea Market.
Mm-hmm.
But they say to sell it to Americans, it has to have some other kind of, it has to have like a chocolate flavor mixed in or blueberry flavor mixed in or something. But it's hard to make it palatable. But you know what? It's funny because we go to these various countries and we often find something new and interesting and are engaged with it. It's funny that this flavor is so out of our realm.
Look, it's tied up into a lot of things, a lot of psychology. But if we discussed before, palates are different all over the world.
But it's such a global world now. It's shocking that there can still be these.
But this proves the opposite side.
Clear,
of it. Yeah.
Strong differences.
Well, there are.
I may try to eat licorice. I mean, it's supposed to be good for you.
Well, in any event, baseball. All right.
Talk about, you know, difficult things
yes,
to like.
And that's not global, right? That's hardly national at this point. But
that's true. That's true. People come from other countries and try to watch baseball.
And they can't.
And they just don't get it.
They just sit and eat their licorice and they don't get it. So it turns out that we have the Dodgers and the Red Sox in the World Series. They once played
before. The Dodgers and the Red Sox.
They played in 1916.
My mother is rooting for the Red Sox.
Again, 1916.
She says it's not that she likes the Red Sox.
Yes.
But she likes them better than the Dodgers.
Unless your mother remembers 1916, I'm going to go
there. I don't think she does.
Okay. So the Brooklyn Superbas were the Dodgers. They called the Brooklyn Superbas.
The Superbas?
Yes. And the Red Sox were the Red Sox. But what's interesting about that is they played the series then. And the Times was gracious enough to publish some excerpts from the coverage of that in the New York Times in 1916. And what's striking is that it turns out that sports writers did not write the same way then as they do now. To wit, here's with the first paragraph about the first game of the World Series. Quote, "The withered stalk of the baseball season burst with a crash into radiant bloom at Braves Field today. The Superbas, pride of Brooklyn, and out of the National League, and the Carmen-hosed Boston Warriors scrambled for the first petals of the blossom."
Carmen-hosed.
Yes. I mean, really? I mean, has sports writing changed?
That conjures up a lot of images.
So I'm reading, and I'm not going to read all this, but it's stunning the way they write about these games. So the first game, they write this. "Under lowering gray skies that finally yielded splashing tears of sympathy for a team mighty even in defeat, the Brooklyn Superbas went down today before the Boston Red Sox in the second encounter of the World Series." How's that? Well, I'm telling you.
Pretty florid.
That's not the way they write the New York Times now. Then when the series went to Brooklyn, the article read, and the Brooklyn played in Ebbets Field, I'll remind you, Lord Ebbets, the squire of Flatbush, had many callers yesterday at his spacious estate. They arrived in taxi cabs and trolley cars. They departed in high dudgeon and low spirits.
That's a little too cute.
Too cute?
Yeah. And Lord Ebbets.
Yes.
Estate.
And here is how the way the game went is described. From the perspective of the Dodgers, after giving the hopes of local fandom the pleasant thrills of a rapid ascent to the mountain peak, they were cast from the summit and dashed to bits on the cruel rocks below. It's pretty dramatic. Ultimately, of course, I shouldn't say of course, but I should tell you that the Red Sox prevailed in what's described a contest that resembled a tug of war between an elephant and a goldfish. So the writing.
So this is 1916. Okay, so that's pre-television. And so I guess it really is. Part of it is literary style, journalistic style of the time.
Right.
But part of it is also an effort to really help you visualize.
Yes, it's to draw you in. And people are reading this, and probably they're reading it without even knowing what happened in the game. They're grab, if you can imagine such a thing, let alone no internet.
There's no radio, there's no anything.
Yeah, so people grabbing the paper, how the superbas do. And now they're sitting down with, you know, whatever, you know, a bold smoking bishop or whatever, and digging into it. So there you have it. But the careful listener might have noticed in that description was the mention of something called Braves Field at the very beginning.
Yes, I did notice that.
Okay, I figured you might have. And you might have said to yourself, why are they mentioning
Braves Field?
It's Boston against the Brooklyn Superbus.
Right, and
the
answer is Atlanta.
There you go. And here's something that even your mother might be interested in.
She wasn't born in 1916
either. Let me get it out first before you decide if she's interested.
Just letting you know.
Okay, I'm aware of that. Boston Red Sox played at Fenway Park, and they still do now in Boston. But there was another team in Boston at the time. It was called the Boston Braves. You mentioned the Atlanta Braves. The Atlanta Braves came from Milwaukee. They were the Milwaukee Braves. But the Milwaukee Braves came from Boston. And for many, many years, there were two teams, an American or National League team in Boston, the Boston Red Sox and the Boston Braves. And you know what? The Braves had the bigger stadium. So when the Red Sox were in the World Series in 1916, they knocked on the door of the Boston Braves and said, can we use your stadium for the World Series?
And they said, for the right price.
I'm sure they did.
Yes.
But the point is that they were a big deal, the Boston Braves, for a long time. They moved in 1952. All right. For some of us, that's a long time ago. For some of us, less so. Right before Hank Aaron signed with the team and they went to Milwaukee. But what relevance does it have to today? Here's the relevance it has to today. In 1990s, the 1994, the Boston Patriots, the New England Patriots now, a very unsuccessful football team, were sold to a guy named Robert Kraft, who still owns the team.
Right.
And the plan, in many people's minds, was because the team was so unsuccessful, it would have to be moved, probably to a place like Jacksonville or St. Louis.
Okay.
And Robert Kraft said, no, we're not moving it. And why did he not move it? Because Robert Kraft was a fan of the Boston Braves. And he's 77 years old today. But when the Boston Braves moved in 1952, he was 12 years old, he remembers crying. He said, it completely rocked my world. There's basically no way for a city to recover when a team moves from the city that has that kind of fandom. So when it came his turn, he said, no amount of money could make up for what I felt when the dedicated fans were lost the team that they rooted for years. And I'm not moving.
Did the Patriots have dedicated fans even though they were big
they
losers?
They did. And that's why they're still in New England.
Okay. Because I was going to say, I don't think the Patriots played baseball.
No. They're football. But the point is, Robert Kraft would have moved the Patriots if he hadn't had the experience he had with the Boston Braves.
Isn't that funny?
There you go.
That you carry these things from the time you're a kid.
But it's perfectly...
And they become...
But it's perfectly,
you know,
believable.
They become perfectly mottos to live by.
Perfectly plausible,
I will not ever move a team.
Yes, but isn't it plausible? Do you believe the story?
Yeah. I do think men get stuck in that rut.
Oh, yes. So that's why the Boston Braves still have an effect even today. So there you have it. So you have museum stuff.
I do have a lot of museum stuff because this is the weekend that the New York Times has a big separate section about everything that's going on in museums. But I want to start it with something that kind of goes with your, literary approach.
Yes. Literary to the newspaper.
Yeah, the passe writing style or whatever. Old write-ups. There's a fun thing in the Wall Street Journal under the heading Snarkitectural Criticism. And it's some descriptions. It's five excoriating reviews of Frank Lloyd Wright's Guggenheim Museum when it opened in 1959. Mm-hmm. If you want to read all five, go to the Wall Street Journal. But I'm just going to read one, and that is by Robert Moses, New York City Parks Commissioner, the power broker. And here's what he said about the Guggenheim. Frank Lloyd Wright's inverted oatmeal dish and silo, with their awkward cantilevering, their jaundiced skin, and the ingenious spiral ramp leading down past abstractions which mirror the tortured maladjustments of our time. Woo!
Ooh, that's negative.
Yes. Shots fired.
Yes.
So I kind of enjoyed
I think people have warmed to the Guggenheim since then.
You know what? Not everybody.
No?
Okay, it's a fun building. Yeah. Does it? Is it any good for displaying art at all? You know, the jury's out. Maybe it, as our concepts of art and varieties of media have expanded, it works better now than it did in 1959. But it's really just, in many ways, kind of Frank Lloyd Wright enjoying himself creating a building and without being overly worried about its function. Anyway, so there you have it. All right, exhibitions one might be interested in seeing include, not all of these recommendations are from the New York Times. I've kind of mashed together a lot I've seen in the last week. And one is at the Neue Museum. Now, the Neue Museum is on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Always fun to go to. It specializes in German art, especially German Expressionism and others from the period. And it's quite lovely inside. It has a wonderful little Viennese cafe. Always interesting to go there. And the exhibition there is one of Franz Marc and August Mack, who are two artists that actually were part of the Blue Rider group with Kandinsky. And the tragedy of them is they both die in World War One. Okay, Mark in 1916, when at I think the age of 36, Mac when he's only in his 20s in 1914. But it is described in the New York Times as being dizzying and thrilling. And so I think that's definitely worth seeing. It's always fun to go to that small, manageable, beautiful museum and see those artists. There's also at the Whitney, now that's the new Whitney, an exhibition of Andy Warhol, From A to B and Back. Okay, it's his evolution from his 1950s as a commercial illustrator to global celebrity in the 80s. And, I gotta say, no matter what you think of his art, most people agree he's,
Marketing genius.
Yeah. His own observation about the paintings of the artist Ad Reinhardt work here. They all look the same, but they're all complicated underneath. Anyway, if you're interested in Warhol, if you're interested in 20th century art, especially pop art, you might be interested in that. It's beginning in November and will go on for a while. At the New York Historical Society, there's an exhibition called History of Magic, including Harry Potter and including, kind of medieval on ideas about magical characters and visualizing dragons, etc.
Yeah,
it sounds like fun. I think they have a lot of activities going on in conjunction with it, but you need tickets. It's one of those tickets with the timed entrance. So you need to go online and find out about the tickets and get those tickets. It is actually from the British Library. Okay, so it's an interesting and fun exhibition. Then at Columbia University's Wallach Gallery, until February 10th, is an interesting exhibition put together by Denise Murrell. And it is called Posing Modernity, the Black Model from Manet/Matisse to Today. Okay, and she really addresses especially seems to me mostly female, I could be wrong, depiction of black females in a variety of art. As she says, from Manet. You know, Manet's most famous depiction is in that painting Olympia of the nude that causes such a sensation in the 1860s in the academic salon. And it's a take on a famous, is it Giorgione, is it Titian, I don't know, painting, reinterpreting famous nudes from the past in the modern vernacular. And his nude, Olympia, is very confrontational, and standing next to her is a servant who is black, handing her some flowers. And what is she saying?
Well, she's quite prominent in the painting. You show
she's prominent. I mean, if you look at the painting, she's 50%. So it's interesting that she's really focused on in terms of who she was, what she was, what is Manet trying to say.
Right. But you also told me you showed me something from Matisse.
And well,
you said
Matisse,
that Matisse in a sense, his evolution reflects the evolution of how the figures evolved, because the way he depicted black female figures changed over time.
Yes. Well, typically at the time, black female was a stand-in for something tremendously exotic, someone very sexual, etc. And he actually travels, Matisse travels to New York, goes to jazz clubs in Harlem, and comes into contact with urban black Americans, and it changes his view of how to portray black people in his art.
And then,
they become much less stylized, less exotic, more
mainstream.
Real.
More mainstream, and they have more modern paintings besides.
Because you remember, in Impressionism, one of the turning the corner of Impressionism is to depict modernity, to depict people as they are and live now. So that was part of Murrell's dissertation, her PhD dissertation, and it covers other periods and other artists as well. And it's actually going to travel to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris in a larger version of this exhibition.
We can see it here.
So she was trying desperately to get Manet's Olympia as part of it, but it does not travel. But she got the Orsay quite interested in the subject, and as a result, they are
co-sponsoring
this exhibition. And finally, Franz Hals at the Toledo Museum of Art. Franz Hals, a family reunion. It's a painting. Toledo thought they had Hals. Turns out they didn't. Turns out it wasn't by Hals. They went shopping for a Hals. They wanted a Hals. They came up with this painting.
It's awful when that happens.
Came up with this painting.
Yeah.
And they bought it knowing that it had been cut down from something else.
So they had half
and it
a
was
painting.
A family portrait of the Van Kampen family.
Right.
But the Van Kampens had 14 kids. There are not too many kids in this piece of it. They find another couple of pieces, actually in the Royal Museum of Fine Arts in Belgium.
Yeah.
And so they have at least two other pieces of this once enormous painting. And again, this is a joint exhibition. It's going to be in Brussels at the Royal Museum in February, but right now it's in Toledo. And, you know, you love Frans Hals. He's a great portrait artist, okay? He's probably, we think, more in terms of Rembrandt and Vermeer when we think of the great painters from this period in the 17th century. He was a great portrait artist with a real sense of a painterly approach. I mean, you really see those exuberant brushstrokes. You think of Velasquez and perhaps John Singer Sargent, other great portrait artists that really let that brushstroke fly. But he also captures people in a really fun way and interesting way. Dynamic group portraits that rather than being, you remember those group soccer team portraits and the, you know, kindergarten class.
Yeah, those are photographs.
Yeah, the
right.
photographs, right. Okay, where everybody, all the kids are sitting there incredibly stiff and, you know, face forward. You know, before Hals, group portraits tend to be more like that, okay? He actually energizes, creates almost conversations going on between the different participants. And he also, there's a wonderful double portrait of Isaac Massa and his wife that is so touching, so intimate, so personal. They're holding on to each other. Their legs are intertwined.
I think you've shown me this.
Yes, it's just...
I think we saw this in the museum.
Yes, it's in the Rijksmuseum.
Yeah.
Of course I showed it to you because it is such...
it's not strange that you showed it to me. It's strange that I remembered it, but I did remember it.
Well, I am delighted. Anyway... Frans Hals, if you're in Toledo.
If you're in, okay.
Catch it.
All right. So.
You can see it in Brussels, if you're in Brussels.
We don't like to talk about law too much. But couldn't help but comment on this. The law of South Korea, this is just a different approach, okay? It turns out that in Korea, not only is it illegal to smoke marijuana, and to gamble, as a matter of fact. But it's illegal even if a South Korean does it outside of the country. In other words, it's not just a law of the land in Korea.
Well, no, that can't be.
It is true. So, in other words...
How do you enforce that?
Well, I'll tell you in just a moment. But it's just the fact that it's the law is scary enough. So that under the country's narcotics law, growing, possessing, transporting, or consuming marijuana is punishable by up to 5 years in prison... and the South Koreans are subject to their country's criminal code no matter where they are in the world. As a result, prosecutors frequently indict returning citizens who experiment with marijuana, as well as those who frequent casinos while overseas.
And well, saying, but again, how do they know? Ah. Do they smell it on their breath or something? Or if somebody orders too many snacks on the plane ride? Or
traditionally, it was tough to know, very tough to know, although... There was such a thing as taking a hard look at folks who had been convicted previously of having smoked marijuana to the extent you could scrutinize somebody. But here's the short answer to your question. The answer is social media and the internet.
People
are out there posting themselves doing crazy things, particularly entertainment figures. So entertainment figures in South Korea come under very great scrutiny because if they're caught smoking marijuana... They're often, by the authorities, paraded for the news media and penalized to make the point that they're enforcing these laws. So this is kind of nuts, and it really comes to the fore now because Canada legalized marijuana, and there are a lot of Koreans in Canada visiting, going to school, whatever they're doing. And so folks were reminded, the South Korean embassy in Canada issued a release that reminded folks that said, please take care not to commit an illegal act because you'll be punished when you get back home. It's legal in Canada, but it's not legal back in South Korea. And you'll be punished when you return. So how strange is that?
It is very strange. It's very unsettling, but I guess they feel really strongly that it's something people shouldn't do.
And yet, still unsettling. So in any, unsettling. I have no answer to that, but that's just weird. But speaking of weird, I understand that Sears was in charge of art for quite a while.
You know, I think you really have to work on your segues, okay? can we make a note of that?
All right, go ahead.
You know, is the engineer listening? Somebody, you know, the director here? Anyway, sadly, Sears is going out of business, right? Okay? And I say that, but on the other hand, when was the last time I bought something at Sears?
Yeah.
So there is that. But we used to all love the catalog.
Right.
Again, we never bought anything from the catalog, but we read it. Quite a bit. Anyway, turns out, did you know Sears and Roebuck sold actual art?
Mm.
Sold actual famous works of art by known artists. An etching signed in the plate by Rembrandt. Etching by Chagall. Photographs by Man Ray. And the most fun of it is, guess who was their buyer for the art?
I know the answer, but go ahead.
Vincent Price.
Okay.
From 1962 to 1971, voracious collector and horror film star Vincent Price acquired over 50,000 pieces of art for Sears and Roebuck, which were sold in the catalogs and stores at accessible prices. So that's kind of fun.
Yes.
Another fun note in the Wall Street Journal is the 25 names Thomas Edison and his colleagues rejected before landing on phonograph. Okay? And I won't read all of them, but there are some funny ones. Didascophone, Minutophone, Chronophone, and I like Melodograph. We could be listening to things on the melodograph.
I think record player might have caught on if they had thought of that one, but I guess that came later.
I wonder who thought of calling them records.
No, I don't know, but go ahead. No segue here.
No segue at all?
Yes.
Okay, well, it's fall,
yes.
And in the fall, in November, Sadie and I always go to Mohonk Mountain House, okay, which is a funny, funny place. In the Catskills, next to the Shawangunks, famous rock formations, etc. And sadly, Albert Smiley III passed away this week. And it was his grandfather, I guess, and his grandfather's brother, Albert and Alfred Smiley, who actually founded the Mohonk Mountain House, took over a rowdy roadside tavern, mm-hmm. and made it into this enormous hotel,
mm-hmm.
Where people would go to get away from the city, largely, and live out in the fresh mountain air and go for hikes. There are fabulous old photographs from the 19th century of these ladies in high buttoned shoes out in the middle of nowhere, hiking up a storm in and around these sort of mountainous paths. Anyway, he passed away. He was somewhat of an innovator. He actually enlarged the hotel, rebuilt, renovated it, and added on a skating rink,
mm-hmm.
and the fabulous spa, which is completely in keeping with the style of the Mohonk Mountain House, but exquisitely modern at the same time, mm-hmm. and very functional. One of the nicest pools I've ever been in. And, you know, he and his wife, Nina, did graduate work at Princeton.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so those Princeton people, they know what they're doing. And then another sad loss is that of Dorcas Riley, who was 92 and actually worked for the Campbell Soup Company. And she lived, I think she passed away in Camden. She's still in the Camden area. And the reason we appreciate her is she was the inventor of the green bean casserole. Okay, that wonderful concoction of green beans, mushroom soup concentrate.
Yeah.
Okay. The can of mushroom soup, right. The Campbell's can you dilute it, soy sauce, a little bit of milk, and on the top, a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
Those crispy French's fried onions.
See, that's what I remember.
And that's what everybody loves. It's that crisp.
Yeah.
It gives it a sort of...
So you had that at Thanksgiving?
Elegance. Everybody in America has that.
But that's funny because it obviously was a Jewish dish because we had it in Thanksgiving. and you had it also? That's very strange.
She says she noted that its appeal was in its simplicity. It employed the popular Midwestern technique of using a creamy soup to bind a casserole. I didn't know that was a Midwestern thing, but it certainly is one of those sort of unifying things. Yes. Maybe for Finland, it's salty licorice. You know, for the United States, it is to some extent green bean casserole. Okay, so these days when all the fresh ingredients are all the rage, and you do see recipes to sort of rework this in a more sort of healthy modern way, yet it's never as good as the old canned stuff. But if you have the love and memory of this, you will never think it's gross. You will think of it as the food of your past, and you will cherish it.
Which
can be said for salty licorice.
I assume that's Miss Riley speaking.
No, actually, it's...
It's the author of the obituary?
Now you're putting me on the spot. It's Ms. Shapiro, who must be... I have no idea who she is. But thank you for alerting our audience to that, okay? All right, obviously, you and I have a lot to talk about, so we better sign off now. This is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff. On Tamsin and Dan, read the paper.